From the Sky News Centre at 6, there's been an astonishing U-turn at Manchester United. Wayne Rooney has agreed a new 5-year contract at the club. It was only 2 days ago that the England striker released a statement saying he wanted to leave Old Trafford. Speaking exclusively to Sky Sports News, here's United chief executive David Gill.
We are delighted, and I think, you know, everyone's moved, and we've made sure that we've retained one of the best players in English and world football, and it's great news for the club, as I say, and for the fans.
Most of the supporters we've spoken to are delighted.
Fantastic news. A player like Wayne, you know, we couldn't afford to lose Wayne.
I think it's great because he scores lots of goals and he's a great player.
A former Roman Catholic priest has been jailed for 21 years for sexual offences against young boys. James Robinson carried out the abuse between the 1950s and 80s and preyed on children in the West Midlands. One of his victims describes what he's been through.
If you don't know your parents well enough to tell them something vile, and it is vile, that he's done to you, you keep it to yourself. You lock it away. I locked it away. I hate and detest the man. He's pure evil.
Previously, secret files on the death of government weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly suggest he did kill himself. Dr. Kelly was found dead in 2003 after he'd emerged as the source of claims that the government sexed up the case for the Iraq War. Attempts to free a nuclear-powered submarine which has run aground off the Isle of Skye are getting underway. The Ministry of Defence says no one was injured when HMS Astute got stuck on rocks. The inquest of a civilian navigator who fell from a military jet as it flew upside down has recorded an accidental death verdict. Former RAF flyer Mike Harland died in 2007 after his seat slipped from an RAF tornado above Norfolk. And 4 photographers claim they've been assaulted by Russell Brand's bodyguards in India. The alleged incident happened at a tiger reserve he was visiting with Katy Perry. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello, it's Ollie here and I present the Youth Show on BCFM 93.2 here on Wednesdays. That's 4 till 5. If you tune in, then you can listen to all the new music that we got coming up, and also I review my album of the week. We've got reviews of Bristol gigs and also our UK festivals as well. We'll talk a little bit about them. So yeah, if you want to listen in, then you can do so on Wednesdays. That's 4 till 5 here on BCFM.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Okay, now they've finished. Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, the Severn Barrage or nuclear power? Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth is here. And who runs Britain? We find out that Brussels has a lot more influence than most people realise and ask why they're not more upfront about the power they hold. But first, the council finalises plans to sell off many of the city's green spaces to developers soon. Time is nearly up for you to find out if your local green space is under threat and to make sure you have your say. Well, as I say, there's only 1 week to go, and one of the campaigners against the sell-off of green space is Rosemary Rendu Jeffries. Welcome to Drive Time, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Now, Rosemary, you were on the show back in September. Can you just give us a little update about how your campaign is going?
The campaign's been going fantastically well. I've just handed in over 1,000 signatures to the council. I've been putting them in different numbers, so they're well over 1,000 now. People do not want this happening. We have a site that we love, and the point is, it's something that we want to keep. We don't want anything changed about it, and we just love it as it is, and that's all we need.
But don't you think, this is a consultation going on here, and you've done your bit, so hopefully now the council will look at this and say, oh, well, we mustn't build on this one.
Well, I don't expect that. That might be completely the opposite way around, of course. They might still think, right, well, there's so much fuss made about Lodge Hill open space that they'll turn around and say, we'll do that first. After all, I've got the assessment from the council, and there is one point, if I can just read this out. The site may add to the value of property that has views and access across. And it is not known if there's any relevance to economic regeneration. So in other words, they consider our site to have value because of its height. Highest point in Bristol, fantastic view, of course. That's, you know, that's what we love about it, and what a developer would love as well.
That's the makes land, gives land a fantastically high value if it's got a good view from it, doesn't it?
That's just what they're saying on this assessment.
This is quite worrying then. It means some of the best little bits of open space where people can see the city from, relax, enjoy a bit of fresh air, if they can find any fresh air.
That's exactly what this is about. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a place of peace, and we need it. We need it as a community. It's our gathering point. This is where we watch the fireworks all together. This is where we watch the planes landing at Filton. If there's a special plane come in, the eclipse of the sun, we use it on a daily basis. Obviously, lots of people use it for exercising their dogs, and that's great. I see them running around over there, have a fantastic time. Children run up and down the slope. This is a free place. You know, people get on there, they've taken photographs. People have their binoculars out. People sit there. We would like our benches back. We do like that. And as the highest point in Bristol, we think this city, as any other city in the world would do, should make the most of this fantastic spot. We would like those kind of little concrete things where they say 100 miles north to so-and-so, across to the Welsh Hills, you know, south to 100 miles, and all this type of point. This is a fantastic place to enjoy. It's not a place to be destroyed by a development and allotments, which I think is just a red herring. The allotments, quite... to be quite honest, this isn't a land for allotments, and I think that's, as I say, a bit of a red herring. So we say no, keep it as it is, we love it.
Now, do you think that the people who live around these green spaces around the city, not just your one, but do you think that the council have made sure that everybody knows that this consultation is happening and that the potentially places near them may be under threat? What's your experience at Lodge Hill?
Well, at Lodge Hill, when my neighbour Pauline, the two of us have been working on this since mid-June, and it just was simply through the Evening Post, Pauline came in to see me. She said, "Have you seen this?" I hadn't. I said, "Pauline, this cannot happen." We immediately, straight away, started writing out a petition. And we then went straight, I emailed to the MP, went straight to see Karen McCarthy, who said, "You must go ahead with this. I am completely behind you." Now, we then started knocking door to door, and the people knew nothing whatsoever. If they weren't a reader of the Evening Post, and let's face it, unfortunately these days not quite as many people used to buy it as used to, just a lifestyle change, and we all knew that was going to happen. And people don't look at the internet, they don't go looking at the government site, the Bristol City site, to see what's going on, unless it's pointed out to them. So the amount of people, everybody said, "No, that cannot possibly happen. We don't know anything about this. Why don't we know?" And, you know, that's how it was. Libraries are okay, but you don't go to the desk in a library to see what's going on necessarily. A few people may, but most people don't. So people were totally in the dark.
So isn't this inevitable, really, that something like this is going to happen? Because the city has such a problem with homelessness, and new homes need to be built.
Now, I understand that the agreement was the target for building new homes over the next 20 years was 30,000. And I understand that two-thirds of these have already been built over the last 5 years, so there's only a third to go. And, you know, this was supposed to be, and it was an agreement made on this strategy, which was just that they would be, the land that was going to be used was land that was actually low value and neglected land. It was places where there were problems with old garages and places like this where there were trouble and odd things. It certainly wasn't our informal green spaces.
Now, so what kind of campaigning activities have you been up to? You've been talking about going door to door, and have you found that there's a sort of upswell of opinion around the city, or what?
Absolutely. Well,
have you made friends with other people in other parts of Bristol?
Absolutely, yes. Now, I have regular contact with other people, other groups around the city, and we all feel exactly the same. We've all been working in the same way, going door to door, putting notices up in local places, running petitions. We've been speaking to each other. We are very much a group. We are working each for our own sites, but we're working as a whole lot of people throughout the city of Bristol, and the feeling is so strong. Of course, we we did go down to College Green. We had about 100 people down there. It was a great day. I mean, you know, it's one of those days you don't know how things are going to go. Of course, we had Kibber the Horse, which was fantastic, possibly leaving his field. And we went into the council house. Now, it was an interesting exercise. Most of us had never been in the council house before and things like that, so it was an experience. And if the city council don't understand the strong feelings, the emotion and the desire for people to keep their green spaces, which is part of our lives, and if, you know, if they don't understand this, then, you know, you must ask council that that they have to be, they have to relook at their strategy.
Well, surely some of these places, it's inevitable, are going to go, aren't they? Some of them are going to go, maybe if either if people didn't know that there was likely to be housing development on them, or if in the summary of when once the planners look at all this, once all the submissions are in, they say, well, actually, there's hardly anybody objecting to this one, so let's build there.
I don't know about that. Obviously, that needs to be looked into. I think it has to be done carefully. I think the council, you know, they must know quite clearly that people on the whole do not agree with this Green Park strategy. There will always be people that don't know about it, don't speak about it, and that perhaps there are sites that haven't been mentioned. But most have, because there are 14 groups over the city that are talking about their green sites. Look at Stockwood, 13 sites. And, you know, this is a terrible thing for them. I mean, it's going to change where they live, which the only thing that Stockwood has basically is the green area, and people need that space, and that's what it's about. I know there's a terrible kind of fear that people have of how they're going to be living in the future, what's happening to them, and people are worried, and I think the council have to be honest, open, and they have to be an understanding of our fears.
But what's going to happen ultimately is some of these places are simply going to get built on, aren't they? I mean, what are you going to do then if you've lost your battle, basically?
Well, you know, obviously we don't know what will happen, and if these things, I mean, a Lodge Hill open space we might well have the bulldozers up there. I personally will be in front of it, you know. I don't intend for anyone to I will fight to the kind of to the death, if you like, to try to stop this happening, because I just feel it's totally wrong. And what we want from the authority is we want some openness, we want some professionalism. We don't want all this kind of, oh, you don't know what you're talking about and all the rest of it, and we've done all this work and this planning, and we spent all your taxpayers' money doing all this over the last 5 years or whatever it is, 2 years, 5 years. Well, we don't care about that. We would respect this authority so much more if they took it in a very professional and open manner, not in an emotional manner. We've had to be emotional because we don't feel that the council will listen to us, and they'll turn around and say, it doesn't matter, we can do what we like, and you are just, you know, you're just, you know, members of the public, and it doesn't matter. I say to the council, it does matter, and I would ask them very much to listen, and we can talk about all this. The last third of the buildings which are going to be built, then there are plenty of buildings, plenty of sites that can be used, which are not our green spaces.
Well, I think this must be done. The thing about green spaces is that they're actually very, very cheap for the developers to buy, and they're much less value. Martin, can you just give us your idea, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, on the necessity or otherwise of this sell-off of these green spaces?
Well, when we had Gary Hopkins on here the other week, he was saying that it's not actually driven by finance. So one of the first things I would say, well, we've got a financial crisis, and that's why the council are doing this. But he said himself that it wasn't a financial decision. It was a decision which had been taken not for financial reasons, but for other reasons.
But it's to do with the maintenance, yeah, apparently, the parks. The idea
behind it, as far as I understood from what he was saying, was that, you know, we want to actually do up our existing parks, so we'll use the money from selling off some of these green spaces to do up the parks that are left. I think what ordinary people can't understand is why we've got this ancient multi-storey car park in Stokes Croft, for example, which is a death trap and has been sitting there for over a decade, and we can't use that to build houses on. But green spaces are up for grabs to be developed. And of course,
well, along Marketing, along Temple Way, for example, as well, there's lots of flattened, derelict sites where offices
indeed,
used to be, for
indeed.
Example.
And ordinary people can't understand why that should be so. And of course, the reason it's so is because the system is geared against. It's geared in favour of the property developer and the property owner, and it has been for a very long time. And of course, if we're talking about building houses as well, we're not talking about building houses for the homeless people here. We're talking about building houses on the top of Lodge Causeway there. Those will be very desirable residences, which will be sold to already comfortably off people. So we're not actually talking about rescuing the people from doorways by building these houses, are we? So it's just... it's crazy, isn't it?
So who's driving this policy? Is it the housing developers or is it Gary Hopkins?
The problem in general is that the law in this country favours developers. Therefore the sites we should be building houses on, like the Stokes Croft site I mentioned or other derelict sites, which is the obvious place to build houses, we can't access those because the people who own those sites are so, you know, the law is all on their side that they can just sit on that and not do anything with it and nobody can do anything about it. Meanwhile, the green space is in the hands of the council. They can do something with that. And it's just because that's the grain of the situation, isn't it? These things need to be changed, really.
Back to you, Rosemary. Can you just explain how you've actually done your submission to the council? You said that you've done a petition as well, but have you done one as a little group or on your own? And how does this process work if people out there are interested in doing it?
We've actually done a variety of things. Yes, the petition was the thing that took off. It took off absolutely immediately with great, great response. There was hardly any opposition. Well, very, very, very few people said, oh, no, I like allotments. That was about the only argument on it. Anyway, the other thing is that we did a statement which was to the council at the council meeting. We have put lots of details together of the reasons why this is such a bad idea. With regard to the road, for instance, the site where this development is going to be, and I might add that if they develop the whole of this area, it's all on the access, the assessment, it says that if they develop the whole of our tiny little space, and it is a tiny little space, about the size of College Green, they would get 80 dwellings on there. Now, 80 dwellings usually means 160 cars, or it could do. Where 160 cars could go, no one knows. And the point is, we are at the top of the hill, a very dangerous top of the hill, where the cars, especially the ambulances, the fire engines, the police cars, and everybody else, goes at speed. And
along similar lines, there's an interesting letter in the Evening Post yesterday from Shirley and Den Hughes, who say that they are an endangered species at Snowdon Road disposal site in fish ponds. We understand the city fathers propose to sell off for development the green spaces around the city that are deemed unnecessary to the health and well-being of the population, therefore bringing to these highly built-up areas even more traffic and pollution, not to mention the ecological impact on the barely surviving flora and fauna. Since when did it make sense to force us into our cars in order to get a breath of fresh air? Kick a ball about, fly a kite, jog along in a safe and secure environment, guarded in the main by the proximity of surrounding homes. So they say they will be joining in a protest march on October the 29th and on December the 12th. You bet. So there's a protest march taking place, Rosemary. What's this about?
Now, that's something I haven't heard about, so that's new to me.
That's the next weekend or next Friday, I think.
I should definitely be looking into it. Now I've retired, I can do these things. And quite honestly, if the people don't gather together and fight together, then between us, we can get something done and we can change, we can get these people to U-turn. When they're doing something wrong, they must listen. And this is so important. It's about the people at the end of the day.
So there is a unified campaign across the city. How do people get in touch with that campaign? It's called Save Green Spaces, I believe, is it?
Oh, yes, Save Our Green Spaces. It's actually begun with a group that are just outside of the city, really. Well, within the city, kind of city, Longwell Green and Wick, Bitton. And Anne Upton has done an awful lot of work on all this for a long time, at least 2 years. And the Save the Green Spaces is now a movement in the Southwest, gathering speed. And we are together we can change things, and that's really what we want to do. And it's really, we all are save our own spaces, save our own area, but we're also save our green spaces is our second subheading, if you like.
Now, if anyone wants to find out if there is a piece of green space near them that is under threat, potentially as part of this sell-off, then there are plenty of leaflets, I know, in the City Council offices themselves, but there's also links from the front page of the Bristol City Council's website if you're on the internet. If you're not, you're going to have to go into the City Council and get those leaflets, and it explains how to put a submission in about any possible green spaces which are under threat in your area. Anyway, Rosemary, thanks ever so much for coming in again. And now, before we leave the subject, I think we have to really read out a letter from a couple of the Conservative councillors from Stockwood, which was also in yesterday's Evening Post, which I thought was particularly interesting. And they are councillors Jay Jethwa and Dave Morris. And they say, while Councillor Gary Hopkins is partially correct, there was initial all-party agreement for the Parks and Area Green Spaces strategy. That was in the Evening Post on the October the 9th. Back in 2008, this was achieved on the clear understanding that only low-value land, i.e. poor quality, neglected and underused plots, would be identified for possible sell-off. However, since that time, the ideas and options plans which has been developed indicate that a dramatic change has taken place. Reality has not matched the precious rhetoric in the consultation papers. Instead of selecting low-value land, officers have gone for prime sites, well-used and loved by local residents. Moreover, we see this pattern repeated right across the city. In Stockwood, the only area of decent level land that is popular with the public for recreational purposes has been targeted for possible redevelopment. No wonder, then, that residents are up in arms. We find it puzzling that Councillor Hopkins is surprised by the strength of local opposition to his park plans. Currently, many residents have commanding views all over the city, as you were saying, Rosemary, and the last thing they want is dozens of houses built on their doorstep. People move to Stockwood because of its semi-rural feel, and the open spaces create a healthy, pollution-free environment. That is what we, as ward councillors, are fighting to preserve. Now, had you come across this idea that originally the intention was to sell off these tiny, low-value bits of land to developers, and we've seen this plan encroach to include some of our best parks?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm in touch with Leslie Alexander, Conservative councillor in our particular ward, and I mean, she has given me details, and she's part of the parts strategy, the group that were looking at these things, and she said the park strategy was in principle a reasonable idea when it was originally proposed, and to sell off low grade land which caused antisocial behaviour, as I said earlier, some garage sites or some places had issues of safety, etc. And this was what was agreed. Somehow this got changed, and our own, not only Leslie Alexander, certainly Kerry McCarthy. I've got a total letter from Kerry. They are definitely saying that this was changed, and they are not for this. They are very much against it.
And so, thanks ever so much, like I said, Rosemary Rendu Jeffries, from coming in. And do you want to give any contact details of people to contact your campaign if they live in your area?
We have my neighbour and I live at the top of Lodge Hill, and the point is that, you know, we can easily be found and contacted. Most people will know where we live, and I've got notices up in the local shops, in the post office in particular, and so we have people that could contact
us. I've noticed that many of these parks that people have actually off their own bat have gone up and stuck notices up saying this park is under threat, and they've put contact details on there. So that's another thing in other parts of the city.
Yes. Well, we live right on the green, and it's easy to find us.
Okay, thanks very much. Now, there is a very dark side to all the cuts that we've been hearing about this week, and that is the fear and nervousness they cause in some of the poorest and most vulnerable in society. So, as our governments start dancing to the bankster's tune, Marina Morris is joining me now, appropriately as ever, to talk about National Stress Day. Hi, Marina.
Hello. National Stress Awareness Day is on the 3rd of November. The latest research by the International Stress Management Association indicated that the greater stress level across the wider workforce has doubled in the last 4 years. Now, national statistics shows stress is one of the biggest problems in life. According to the Health and Safety Executive, the increase in the stress profile is related to the very large change in working condition, including programs of downsizing and reorganization, an increase in short-term contracts, outsourcing, and the introduction of a new technology. The Health and Safety Executive's occupational supplement on work-related stress and related disorders shows that the self-reported incidence of stress, depression, or anxiety is significantly greatest in professional, managerial, and administrational staff, with around 2% reported in 2004 that their job had created or made this condition worse. Not only the health service, but many other professions are now monitoring their stress statistics. According to the recent survey by the Chartered Accountants Benevolent Society published in October 2010, 82% of accountants believe that they suffer from the stress, 77% highlighting long working hours as an issue, and 71% believing that their work-life balance is poor. More than a quarter of accountants drink too much alcohol, and an eighth have misused drugs. The suicide rate for female accountants is around 3 times the national average. I quote the Prime Minister's speech at the Conservative Conference, "Try the big things, do the right things." Parliament has created an ambitious high-pressure climate in the country to target economic stability. Is the government hiding behind the deficit? Is the government taking responsibility for the huge impact on people's mental well-being? And what will be the cost? By contrast, suicide and depression cost Japan $32 billion UK's dollars in treatment and lost income last year, according to a Ministry of Health study. Their suicide rate for Japanese women is the highest in the G8. As the impact of the comprehensive spending review filters down through the public service, public service managers and accountants can expect to be very aware of a stressed on National Stress Day, the 3rd of November.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, is here again. Martin, I mean, this is almost like a double whammy, isn't it? First, we've got the war on terror. We're fighting, we've got to be biting our nails all the time because we never know when a terrorist is going to be blowing up a bomb near us. And now we're being told by our financial managers that we've got all these austerity measures. I mean, how does this affect people psychologically?
Well, I think, obviously, one of the problems we have is that even though productivity in the economy rises year by year, and we're actually wealthier and wealthier, we're actually more and more unhappy. And if you look at the strikes and confrontations that are going on in France now, the French workers are actually some of the most productive in Europe. They're more productive per head than German workers. But the French, over a generation, have decided that they would rather take their extra productivity in long holidays and early retirement rather than more stuff. And I think that's rather wise of the French. And of course, they are now fighting to defend their right to early retirement, their right to take long holidays. And that if the French worked as hard as the Japanese, they would be as rich as the Japanese. But they don't want to. They want to have holidays.
But why
and they want to spend time with their families.
But why does it make...
Perhaps we need to be thinking about doing that.
Well, what I'm saying is, why does it make sense to have a portion of the population working incredibly hard and getting very stressed out, working longer and longer hours with threats to their job, and then another quite large slice of the population simply languishing and unemployed?
Well, I mean, it's very stressful for me this week. I was turned down for a job interview. And that's the kind of stress I'm facing because I'm trying to get my foot back into the world of work. Others are in work and they're being driven mad by insecurity. So my sister, for example, is on a casual contract in this school where she's working. She has to go in every week and see if there's any work for her. All of these things add to mental stress and mental illness. It's absurd, really, because actually we're far more productive as a society than we were even 10 years ago, certainly than we were 30 years ago. But actually, this is all turning into a mental health disaster because we don't seem to be able to manage the forces that we've unleashed. And we need to take a step back and decide what our values actually are. We're not put on this earth to work ourselves to death. We're here to do other things.
Okay, Martin. So now you haven't got your job, you'll have spare time to do other things, won't you?
Indeed, I do. Like coming on this programme, for example.
Okay. Well, it's been a big week for the environment and energy, with a 180-degree U-turn by the Liberal Democrat Energy Secretary Chris Huhne, who before the election had been condemning nuclear power as totally unaffordable and environmentally destructive. Now, he's all for it. Anyway, I'm joined now by Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth, who are based in Montpellier. Hi, Mike, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thank you.
Now, what's your reaction, first of all, then, to the announcement on Monday about the barrage across the Severn, which is going to be cancelled?
I can't say it was a reaction of huge surprise. I think it was pretty much on the cards the way the studies have been going over the past few months. It looked like we're in for a repeat of what happened nearly 20 years ago now, when the government then set up a study and looked at various options for a Severn tidal power barrage, concluded it was too expensive and the project died a death. Now, I think there was a good argument for looking at the issue again and saying, you know, there is a huge energy resource out there with the tides in the Severn estuary, some of the strongest tides anywhere in the world. It makes sense to look at how we might be able to use that to generate clean electricity. But I'm afraid that the project was really pretty doomed from the start, because they went right back to the exactly the same project as they'd ruled out 20 years previously as being too expensive, which was the Cardiff to Western barrage. That's something we were never happy about because of the huge environmental impact it would have. The Severn estuary isn't only hugely important for its tidal energy, it's also hugely important for its wildlife. So,
but you can't have it both ways, you environmentalists, can you? Because you want to have green energy too. And you're saying that actually the environmental impact of that green energy is going to affect the wildlife, the birds and things like that. Splinbridge, for example.
Yeah, if it's the wrong kind of project built in the wrong place, so, then yeah, those impacts will be unacceptable.
Now,
But you know, we were worried that they weren't giving enough emphasis to other potential tidal power schemes in the Severn, which could potentially generate a very worthwhile amount of energy, but without that huge environmental impact.
Now, Cardiff Bay had a barrage put across it a few years ago. How's that gone from an environmentalist perspective?
Well, it's had the effect that we predicted. I mean, it cut off a small part of the estuary, the wading birds, the migratory birds that came there every winter and used to feed there on the exposed mudflats weren't able to any longer because it's all been drowned, those birds essentially were lost to the world because of that.
I mean, are you happy for that to happen in small areas like Cardiff Bay? And what you're saying that this shouldn't happen anywhere, because we are very lucky here, aren't we, in having such an amazing tidal reach that goes up and down every day, twice. You know, surely there's vast amounts of water moving around. Why can't we do that, say, for example, near the Clifton Suspension Bridge, somewhere like that, where there's all this water moving backwards and forwards?
I think that would not necessarily be the best location for it, but somewhere out in the middle of the channel, out in the Bristol Channel, you see, you could build a self-contained sort of lagoon that would allow the water to come in on the incoming tide, and then you could pen it in and let it out through sluices, through turbines on the outgoing tide, and generate electricity that way in exactly the same way as a barrage would, but you wouldn't actually impede the passage of water in and out of the main estuary, and in that way you could get a win-win scheme that would actually allow you to generate tidal electricity but also preserve the best of the estuary for the wildlife.
But I mean, you know, surely you're being a little bit finicky here about these wading birds. I mean, you don't see too many of them here in Bristol, and if one part of the estuary, somewhere on the Severn estuary, is closed to them, well, they can just literally fly across, can't they, and land somewhere else. There's loads of mud around the Severn.
Well, that was the experience of Cardiff Bay, was not that they could just fly away and use somewhere else. That they weren't able to do that. The extra resource wasn't there for them. And so those birds, you know, the population of those birds declined because they didn't have the extra space to go to. So you've got to be quite careful ecologically about what you do with such an important area as this. But, you know, on the whole, we're kind of right behind the development of tidal power, and we think it should be, you know, we're delighted that the wave hub has been installed off the north coast of Cornwall. They'll be testing, they'll be having sea trials there for commercial scale wave and tidal energy devices. That's fantastic, and you know, put them in the right place. There's always going to be some kind of impact, but not anywhere, you know, the sensitivity of the Severn estuary is too great to have that.
So you're saying that we shouldn't have this anywhere around the Severn estuary?
No, I think we could be looking at, we certainly could be seeing some of of these smaller schemes developed in the Severn Estuary. That could be very beneficial, and there would be a minimal impact on the environment. But unfortunately, the study that's just been concluded, they were going for the big one, the biggest one, which had the biggest environment impact, and it cost more than £34 billion. So it ain't going to happen.
Right. What's happening with nuclear power?
Yes. Well...
Are you one of these greenies that thinks that nuclear is green?
No, I'm certainly not persuaded of that. I've got a long memory. I know that you can't trust what the nuclear industry tell you. This is about the third or fourth time in my lifetime that the nuclear industry has sort of set itself up proclaiming, you know, we're the industry of the future. We're just about on the cusp of a huge wave of developing the nuclear power stations. And every time it hasn't happened, every time the economics of it have proved to be disastrously miscalculated, every time the taxpayers ends up with a huge liability for clearing up the mess of the previous generation of nuclear power stations. And the problems that they claim they have resolved with the latest generation of reactors, well, the experience is just repeating itself again. Now in France and in Finland, again, they're building big-scale reactors, but already these programs are running 2-3 years behind schedule, massively over budget. So don't believe what the nuclear industry tell you about the costs.
Well, I'm afraid it's not my decision. I mean, I don't necessarily believe them. But do you think that these power stations in the Severn Estuary, projected new ones, are going to go ahead? Because certainly people like EDF are saying that they're actually going to be a lot safer because they're going to be containing any radiation and radioactive waste, which I imagine is quite a lot of from one of these stations. It's going to be contained on site. They're not going to be transporting it through Temple Meads anymore, which they have been doing up to Sellafield.
Well, as I understand it, the reason for that is that the waste is that much hotter and more radioactive than it is from the current generation of power stations. They can't transport it off-site. So actually what you're looking at is a nuclear waste containment on the coast by Somerset or by Hinkley Point or up at Oldbury for over 100 years, 160 years, having to store that waste on-site.
Crikey, it must be pretty hot. These fuel rods, when they come out of the reactor, must be pretty hot, because I know the existing stations, they have to leave the fuel rods in a bath of water, basically it's like a giant swimming pool, for a year for them to cool down, so they're cool enough that they can transport them. So these new stations must be producing some pretty hot reactor rods.
I think they must, yeah.
So we're being told, really, aren't we, by Friends of the Earth, that there's not much we can do then, are we, around the Bristol Channel to generate electricity?
Well, there are proposals for Bristol City Council has got the go ahead for two large wind turbines down at Avonmouth, which hopefully will happen this year.
But there's hang on, Mike, because those wind turbines aren't going to generate as much power as a nuclear power station or the barrage.
Well, if you're talking about what we can do around the Severn Estuary, yeah, there's a private developer who's proposed, got a scheme by Thornbury for four wind turbines. There's three Port of Bristol, there's a couple over by Newport. So actually we're getting quite a significant development of a wind energy resource around the estuary. But actually in all the stuff that's gone on about the bad news from the comprehensive spending review, one thing that hasn't been really remarked on was actually a piece of good news, that the green energy reward scheme, the so-called feed-in tariff, has been saved. It's not been scrapped.
What is it?
And
what is
that
it?
Basically means that individual householders, small businesses, community centres, churches can install on your property solar panels to generate electricity from the sun, or if you've got land, wind turbines generating green electricity from wind or sun, and you get a guaranteed rate of return for any electricity that you put into the grid, and it transforms the economics of small-scale renewable energy. Well, I think this has got huge potential. I was on my way here, I was just looking across at the tower blocks around this area and around Barton Hill and Lawrence Hill, and thinking, hey, you know, there's a big south-facing walls there. Those could, you know, virtually be transformed into sort of mini power stations, you know. And the great thing about this tariff is that it's not just something that enables, you know, middle-class householders to have a bit of green bling on their houses, but it can be used by local authorities, it can be used by social landlords, by housing associations, so they can get the double benefit. They can bring down the electricity bills for their tenants, but they can also be getting this special tariff from the government because it's a green energy source that enables them to find finance the whole operation and recycle those profits.
Martin Summers is sitting here patiently listening. Martin, what do you think of the economics of all this? I mean, particularly this swing around by the Liberal Democrats, Chris Hume in particular, from being vehemently anti-nuclear to now being for it.
Well, that's a political rather than an economic point, isn't it?
But
really?
Has he thought
through the economics of
it?
I suspect that they're not going to be able to afford these nuclear power stations either. That's possibly what will happen, is that they will find us that the cost overruns that you were mentioning earlier could put the kibosh on this. But I think we misconceive or misperceive the problem, which is that we say we've got to have a certain amount of energy generated, and therefore we've now got to find a solution to that. Whereas in actual fact, I mean, when I used to work for the New Economics Foundation in the 1990s, I helped to circulate in Eastern Europe a document produced by the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado by Amory Lovins. Yeah. And he was basically saying, look, the solution to all of this is much simpler than people realise. It's energy efficiency. It's quite straightforward technology. We've just got to design everything to be super energy efficient. And we've got to retrofit everything to be super energy efficient. And it doesn't require any great big leaps of technology. We know what to do. It just costs a lot of money. But it costs a lot less money than building these mega schemes, which always have a flaw, don't they? Yeah. Whenever you try and do something on a big scale, there's usually some kind of knock-on effect that you haven't taken account of. And, of course, the other thing you're not taking account of is you can't really make this pay. None of these schemes can actually function in a free market economy. They can only function in a command economy, which is why the Soviet Union's got so many nuclear reactors, because money wasn't any object.
Anyway, Mike, to round up, can you just explain a bit about Friends of the Earth, and if people are interested, how they can join?
Yes, thanks, Tony. We're a local group. We're volunteers. We meet once a month, usually down in King Street. People can find us on the web, Bristol Friends of the Earth or Bristol Foe. Get in touch with us, or you can write to us at 10 to 12 Picton Street. And we'll send you information. We're an open organisation. Anybody's free to join. We welcome new members, and please do come along to a meeting.
And do you have any sort of a particular objective that you've had all the time since Friends of the Earth started? What exactly is the I mean, I know it's an environmental campaign, but what's the absolute actual focus of it all?
Well, I think the problem's been that it's kind of tackling a many-headed beast. You know, you deal with kind of one environmental problem, and then another one comes up to take its place. But do you know, we started the Bristol Friends of the Earth, one of the very first local groups in the country, nearly 40 years ago. We took a load of glass bottles back to a depot of the drinks firm Schweppes, because basically they were getting rid of the system where you used to have it. Used to be able to return bottles for them to be reused.
Oh, this is reusing rather than recycling. Fantastic. I remember that. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And I think that is still an issue. We're still making far too many resources that are just used once and thrown away, or not effectively recycled. We don't, you know, we're at the manufacturing stage, we don't think about what happens at the end of the life of that product. We still don't make things to be reused and recycled. And that, if you like, is a theme that has stayed with Friends of the Earth ever since we started.
Now, have you ever thought and puzzled over the economics of why it is that it might be actually cheaper for big companies like Schweppes to produce loads of these bottles and then just sort of basically throw them away with the product, rather than to ask for the people to bring them back again?
It's a huge question, but I think at the root of it is the fact that the companies don't pay the what you call the externalised costs. They don't pay the real costs. So they don't pay for the landfill, they don't pay for the degradation of air and water, they don't pay for the degradation that is caused where these resources are mined. Those are constantly written off of the account books. So economics is, in that sense, it's fraudulent. It's not paying account of the real environmental and social human cost of that damage.
Mike Perkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth, thanks very much.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, many times on this programme, we've asked the question why people don't feel there's any point in voting. How robust is our democratic system when the Treasury and the Chancellor seem to treat the banks and the city with kid gloves? Well, I'm joined now by Dave Barmby from Oxfordshire, who's an independent researcher. Hi, Dave, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. It's nice to see you again.
Now, are you a member of a political party?
I am, but I'd rather not say who it is, because the political party is purely incidental. I'm basically an independent thinker.
Okay. Now, a few people, talk about the EU as a kind of Fourth Reich. So why might that be?
A Fourth Reich? Well, I think there are some conspiracy theories. I use the word conspiracy theory advisedly because the word conspiracy theory is used as a put-down by people. And these words are generated by the New World Order, I believe, and they're used time and time again, and they're used in different countries, so they must come from a particular source. So conspiracy theory is a way of saying you're a liar, go away.
Well, but there are some sort of nutty conspiracy theories, and there are some more sensible ones. Yeah, and maybe this concept, the word conspiracy theory, tries to lump them all together.
That's right.
Anyway,
I'd just like to say on that, if somebody invents stuff without researching it properly, then I would say yes, it could be construed as a conspiracy theory. But if you do research and prove everything, some of it you can't prove, some of it is comes from intuition, but generally speaking, if you do your work properly, you can't be accused of being a conspiracy theorist.
Now, ultimately, power springs from the people, doesn't it?
Well, I believe power should spring from the people. It used to in Saxon times, and when the country was invaded by the Normans, I think we entered a feudal era, which lasted until about 1832, when we had the first Reform Act, which started giving the vote to people.
Now, don't you think some people look upon the sort of pre-Norman, the Saxon thing, with a bit of sort of rose-tinted glasses? Because, surely it was pretty rough before and after the Norman invasion.
Well, I'm no expert on Saxon history, but people who have that expertise say there was quite a degree of democracy. The communities were small, and you elected your local leader and so forth. I think there's some truth to it.
Well, one thing you can definitely say is that the people who were living in Britain at the time of the Norman invasion definitely decided they wanted to kick out the Normans. I mean, there's all sorts of rebellions and all this kind of thing. They didn't want to be ruled by these new people run by William the Conqueror. Anyway, I know you've been looking at some of sources of power generally nowadays, more up to date, and that you seem to be quite a fan of Tony Benn.
Well, yes, I've heard Tony Benn speak on a number of occasions, and I think he is...
He's a former Bristol MP, you know.
That's right, yes. I don't agree with him on everything, but he does have democratic credentials. He is a political philosopher of a first order, of the order of Tom Paine, probably not the same degree as Tom Paine. Probably most people have never heard of Tom Paine, but he was a 18th century political philosopher, and people should really look him up if they want to get a handle on the lack of democracy in this country. But Tony Benn, if I may, produced a speech, and he sent me the notes on it, and he explained where sources of power come from. And I'll just briefly go through the basic sources of power. There's the power of conquest. If you're conquered, then there's no democracy in being conquered. You have to do what you're told until they establish a democratic system. There's the power of ownership, which nowadays we find in multinational bankers and multinational corporations and the global banking system. This is what I object to, controlling the democratic system. There's the power of faith, which has a big influence in the Muslim world, for instance. Power of knowledge, knowledge is power. Power from science and technology, and power through the ballot box. Now, it's unfortunately the ballot box which is the problem.
Oh, why do you say that? Why is the ballot box? Surely that's the part of the solution, isn't it, to democracy?
Yes, the ballot box should be part of the system, but to be quite honest, I think it's a bit of a scam these days, because we've seen... We used to have a tripartite system where we had the House of Lords, House of Commons, and the Queen, or the monarch, used to provide all these parts, all these three had to pass the bills or sign the bills off. But we saw the power of the House of Lords wane after the 1911 Parliament Act, where they were stripped of their powers to stop any legislation going through, and the Queen seems to have been intimidated into not speaking up anymore. There's some some reasons why she can't. But
surely the Queen, she does her work kind of almost like behind the scenes, isn't she? She has her weekly meetings with the Prime Minister, and yes, she doesn't do it in a public sphere. She's a kind of backroom operator.
That's about it, yes. But she doesn't sign any, she doesn't sign any bills. She doesn't read any bills. It's all done by the royal prerogative, which means some civil servant somewhere putting their X somewhere.
Now, I know you've got a bit of a bee in your bonnet about the European Union, and I think there's many people out there. I mean, as we saw this week, for example, at Prime Minister's Question Time on Wednesday, I don't know if you heard it, Dave, but the very first question was by a Conservative MP, and here he is talking about some of the... In fact, the first point he made was how much money, and this is just before the Comprehensive Spending Review, goes to Europe. So so let's just have a listen to Prime Minister's questions from earlier on. Yes,
do you want to play your
No.
Okay. Well, I'd like to broaden that a bit because I think the spending review missed out some grand opportunities. For instance, Quango's, I believe, costs over 100 billion per year, and we were told that we're going to see these Quangos abolished, or most of them abolished, but what do we see? Only a very few actually abolished, and most of them amalgamated and brought into the civil service.
But these Quangos are crucial, aren't they? I mean, they do all sorts of really important work at arm's length from government. So they're not actually, the government isn't actually controlling the Quango, it's an arm's length. I mean, for example, the Civil Aviation Authority is a Quango. We don't want to get rid of that, do we? Well, otherwise, we have planes crashing into each other.
Absolutely obvious. But then, of course, the European Union set up a Civil Aviation Authority. Why do we need two of everything?
So are you saying that actually maybe that there are these other European Quangos which are slowly going to take over as these Quangos are being abolished?
Obviously, and but getting back to saving money, I believe that, yes, obviously you have to have some agencies which do things, but most of them were jobs for the boys, and I think we could have saved 50, 60 billion there. We could have saved... I'm against the Afghan war. There may be listeners out there who think it's a good thing, but I think I can't see the reason for it other than to train troops. And the result of that is that we're seeing lots of people losing their legs and arms and so forth. And we could save 3.8 billion by getting rid of that. But on the EU itself, the EU is costing us 15.3 billion for 2010. And we get some of that back, not very much, but it's on projects designed by the European Union. You have to fly the European Union flag with that, and I see that some organisations didn't fly the EU flag and got fined, and we've been fined £150 million for not flying a flag of occupation. And then there's the regulation, which is an even bigger cost to the country.
Before we get on to that, Dave, we're going to go back to Wednesday to Prime Minister's Questions to hear what this Conservative MP had to say about the cost of the European Union.
Right.
The European Union will increase by £17.5 billion. So yesterday's cuts to the defence budget will not go to reduce the deficit, but to subsidise our European partners. This is obscene. What would the Prime Minister like to say to the European Union?
Well, first of all, the point is it was the previous government gave away around £8 billion.
Conservatives are now pointing at the Labour benches.
£8 billion of rebate and got nothing in return. I am absolutely clear we will not accept any increases in the EU budget in the next seven-year financial perspective. We've called for a cash freeze in the size of the EU budget for 2011, and we're working very hard to make this case across Europe. Just yesterday I spoke to the new Dutch Prime Minister, as he is another ally in trying to make sure that as we make difficult decisions at home, we do not spend extra money on the EU budget.
So why is it, do you think, that we're continuing to spend quite a lot of money on the EU budget and yet we're cutting here back at home?
Well, the EU is sacrosanct. You can't criticise it. There's papers going back to the 1970s where ministers and civil servants were told they must not criticise the European
Union. We've just heard a Conservative MP at Prime Minister's Question criticising it there, haven't we?
Yeah, well, he hasn't read the book, has he? But I hope that David Cameron is going to actually live up to his word and refuse to give any more money to the European Union, because there's a lot of tremendous wastage there. None of it is democratically passed through.
Hang on, we all vote for MEPs. What do you mean it's not democratic?
Well, MEPs have no power. They're rubber stampers in the European Parliament, basically. All the legislation that comes out of the EU comes through from the Commission. And just on that very subject, since David Cameron was elected in May, we've had a total of 1,046 regulations, directives and directives passed by the European Union undemocratically, which this country is going to have to obey. And of course, we, in probably at least two or three years ago, 80% of our laws were made by the unelectable, unsackable, unaccountable people over in Brussels.
Now, I know one of the things you're a bit of an expert on, Dave, is the origins of the European Union. You have, I think, is somebody called Paul Henry Spack, who actually was one of the people that set it up. He was part of something called the European Movement. Now, what did you find out about him?
Well, Paul Henry Spack was one of the so-called founding fathers, and he was leader of the European Movement from 1950 to about 1950, 54, 55. And he quite rightly said, without the European Movement, there would be no EU. The European Movement was set up as a so-called grassroots organisation to encourage the people to believe in the whole project. But in actual fact, the European Movement was nothing of the sort. The European Movement was set up initially by Churchill, but he couldn't get off the ground because nobody was particularly interested in giving up their nationhood. Went back nearly bankrupt in the late 40s, and Duncan Sands and a chap called Rettinger went over to the States to try and encourage big business in the States to support it. And there's an organisation called ACU, American Committee for United Europe, who are the backers of the European Movement.
Now, on your little list here of organisations that helped get the European Union going, I noticed the American Central Intelligence Agency is on the list.
Yes, the CIA came in a bit later after American Committee for United Europe. I just go back to the ACU, the American Committee for United Europe. That was set up and financed by a large number of big multinationals who could see that a new world order was just the thing that they needed for business reasons.
Now, this world term, a new world order, maybe I could bring Martin, I could bring you in here. We hear this again and again, and it seems that there are some legitimate concerns that there's a sort of push for world government, but then there's also the thought that, well, actually, this is just a term which is used as a sort of nice term of abuse for anybody that's trying a kind of federalist approach, Martin.
Well, I think people use the word New World Order to mean what they want it to mean. For some people, it means a conspiratorial world government. For others, it means something relatively positive. I think you've got to define your terms when you're talking about things like this. I mean, you know, the word New World Order could mean anything that people want it to mean, basically.
Well, I would just like to say that, just as an illustration of how the great and the good, the multinational banker, the global bankers, get in on the act, I was reading a book by Douglas Hurd, who was the foreign secretary in the 1990s, and I was very struck with a little paragraph there, which you haven't got much time to read out, but he said, "I became a junior ally." Don't forget, Hurd was the private secretary of Ted Heath in the 1970s, 1972, when we entered the European Union. He said, "I became a junior ally of Lord Rothschild, the big banking conglomerate, and his useful central policy staff. It was set up to be the anointed rebel within the system, the grit in Whitehall oyster, designed to produce a harvest of pearls. It was one of Ted Heath's most striking innovations, a servant of the cabinet, not the prime minister. It was fascinating, listen to this, it was fascinating to watch Ted Heath and his cabinet humble themselves at regular reviews of strategy presented to them at Chequers by Victor Rothschild." So there we have the great and the good, the global bankers influencing the government at the time we were going to the European Union. I wrote to Hurd and asked him, did he have any influence upon Ted Heath in pushing him into the EU? he hasn't replied, though he normally replies to me.
Now, one of the more worrying arms, of course, is the Bilderberg conferences, which I have a website about and I cover pretty much every year. We've had The Guardian covering it the last couple of years with Charlie Skelton too. These are very, very secretive conferences with the IMF, the World Bank. We've got royalty. We've got the leaders of some of the biggest multinationals, including big oil companies in the world. What can you tell us about the Bilderbergs, Dave?
Well, I actually have 10 years worth of archives, which I dug up.
But what's the purpose of the group?
Well, the purpose of the group is for the multinational companies, the global bankers, to influence how the world is going to
well,
be.
Well, the interesting
run.
Thing, of course, is also at the moment we've got Kenneth Clark, who's the Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor, who is the main Bilderberg representative. The thing that bothers me about it all, and I know bothers Martin, is that these elected politicians are going along to secret meetings and we're not allowed to know what's discussed inside. In fact, they actually voluntarily sign up to a code of secrecy before they walk in the door. So you have to wonder where their loyalties lie. Anyway, we're going to have to leave it there. It's three big events coming up this weekend. A march and rally against the cuts is taking place tomorrow, organised by Bristol Unions. It starts at Castle Park at 11 a.m, winds through the city and ends up with a rally and speakers at College Green at 12 noon. There's also a national anti-nuclear campaigning and strategy conference. Finally, a blogging conference. What's the blogging story? Begins at 7 p.m. this evening at the Watershed. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, leader of Bristol City Council and Lib Dem councillor for Clifton, Barbara Jenk. And to reporters Marina Morris and Clive Somerville. Thanks also to Rosemary Rendu-Jeffries from the Save Bristol Green Spaces, to Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth, independent researcher.